KaiserNetwork.org.
Welcome to From the Bookshelves. I'm Jackie Judd with the Kaiser Family Foundation. Rationing has become one of the most feared words in the debate over how to rein in national spending on health care. Henry Aaron and colleagues at the Brookings Institution have written a book examining Britain's experience with rationing and how rationing can be a sensible approach in terms of budgets and public health outcome. The book is Can We Say No? The Challenge of Rationing Healthcare. And Henry Aaron joins us now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
You say in the book that a discussion, a debate, possible implementation of rationing is inescapable. I think a lot of people in the policy world might disagree with that. Why do you believe that's true?
Well, let's start with the basic facts. For the past half century or more, the growth of per capita healthcare spending has outpaced income growth by about 2.5 percentage points a year. It doesn't sound like terribly much, but over time, it builds to a huge increase in the share of our income that goes for healthcare. Given a continuation of those trends, and there's really no reason to think they're going to slow down or that that gap is going to close, we'll be spending something on the order of a third of our national income on health care by sometime a little after 2030. We would have to see taxes increase to sustain our current commitments to the elderly, disabled, and poor by about doubling. That is, income and payroll taxes would have to approximately double. Now, if all of that money was going for things that you knew was were worth what they cost, that would be fine. We spend more on automobiles than we did on horses and buggies, and nobody complains about that. But in the case of health care, we are spending other people's money for the great majority of the health care we consume. That's inevitable. Even if one substantially raised deductibles, as President Bush is now proposing, the vast majority of what we spend on health care would be during episodes that cost so much that any decent health insurance policy, even one with a high deductible, would cover essentially all of your costs. Now, what happens then?
You argue the benefit is not always worth the cost.
Exactly. And the reason is, if I'm paying 10 cents on the dollar for health care, I want the care as long as it gives me a dime worth of benefits. Somebody else is paying that 90 cents. When health care didn't account for a very large part of our total consumption, that was something we tolerated, maybe we even welcomed, because when we're sick, we don't want to have to think about money. But when health care spending is becoming so large that it is crowding out, well, first of all, requiring very large increases in taxes, mm-hmm. or crowding out our capacity to consume more of anything else, that kind of a situation becomes very, very difficult to sustain.
And when you talk about rationing, I think there's a lot of misperceptions about what that word means in the context of healthcare. What does it mean to you? How can it be sensible and intelligent?
Well, I agree with you. Rationing is a four-letter word in policy discussions. And I think that perception is incorrect. Done badly, ham-fistedly, by bureaucrats, blindly, slashing one particular service or another, ruling out certain classes of beneficiaries, doing it in an insensitive fashion, it could be a four-letter word, and worse. But the key here is that a great deal of what we do in healthcare generates very small benefits. So what we need to do is try to fashion methods of paying physicians and other healthcare providers, methods of limiting the supply of certain kinds of health services that are currently overused. I can tell you stories about that from my own personal experience. In a way that gets rid of those services that are worth less than they cost while retaining those that are. And I want to emphasize the advance in medicine that we have enjoyed to date is monumentally beneficial. Two separate economic studies have estimated that the gain in welfare from the improvement in life expectancy and the reduction in morbidity that's occurred over the last 30 years has been as great as the increase in welfare from all other economic growth. There's no reason to think that in the age of the genomic revolution, that's going to change. So more health care, scientific advance is something we really have to not discourage. But we can't afford, I believe, over the long haul, to continue to indulge a system that causes us to buy a lot of health care that isn't, at the margin, what it's worth.
I want to move on to your examination of the British system, but I'll just say parenthetically that I think a lot of people would argue that if we had rationing, then the breakthroughs stop, because the financial incentives won't always be there.
I think that's a real problem. It's one that has troubled me a lot. And the answer, it may not be a perfect answer, is that to the extent that limits are placed in one way or another, through the marketplace, through regulations, on how much is spent on healthcare directly, the responsibility of government and foundations to underwrite biomedical research increases rather than decreases. Because it is true, the financial incentives drive a lot of research. If those become weaker, we don't want to cut off this golden goose.
Let's talk about the British experience for a moment. You look at their system of medicine from a lot of different perspectives, including the experience with kidney dialysis.
Yes.
It's a mixed picture.
Exceedingly. Frightening in many ways, but I think revelatory of the sort of situation that would occur here.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we did a book 20 years ago, and we looked at kidney dialysis then, and the situation then was pretty stark. If you were over 50, certainly over 55, and your kidneys failed in Britain, you were very likely not to be dialyzed or to receive a kidney transplant.
What was the word one of the doctors used? After
yes.
50, you're crumbly?
Everybody over 50 is a little bit crumbly. That was the rationalization. Now, that's serious, because if your kidneys have failed and you're not dialyzed or transplanted, you die. Well, what's happened since then? What has happened since then is that the British have invested a great deal more in kidney dialysis and transplantation than they did then. The age cutoffs are gone, but the gap between provision there and here is just as large in relative terms, and even larger in absolute terms than it was then. Why? Well, there's been an epidemic of kidney failure that comes from diabetes, that comes from obesity. There are certain populations, mostly minority populations, that are peculiarly prone to this condition, and there have been an increasing number in both of our countries, but particularly in Britain. So that what one has now is a situation where the age cutoffs are gone, but as one doctor put it, there are still bedside decisions that are made not to provide care in situations where almost certainly it would be provided in the United States.
And that's code for letting them go.
That's correct. Now, in some cases, I think many American physicians and patients who have been through the process of watching a loved one die would say that, you know, keeping somebody who is comatose alive with dialysis a few weeks more, a few months more, is no favor really to anyone. But there are other cases where the lack of access can be very serious and have genuinely adverse consequences. There's another aspect of the British experience that's really quite fascinating. The nephrologists there are really well organized, and so are the patients. One of the nephrologists said to us, you know, he said, there's nothing more powerful than having a patient stand up before a member of parliament and say, you know, without dialysis, I'd be dead in 3 weeks. And it's true, they would be.
But what lessons should American policymakers take from this experience with this one slice of kidney dialysis?
Well, I think the lessons primarily are comparing the relative levels of care provided through different sorts of technologies and why it's the case that the British do as much as we do of some things and very much less of kidney dialysis and other things of that kind. One of them is, if it really costs a lot to provide care to everybody, mm-hmm. the pressure to ration is severe. if it is a condition that overwhelmingly affects the elderly as opposed to the young, rationing will be more severe. Mm-hmm. If patients can't mobilize, this is a case where dialysis cuts the other way, then rationing will be more severe. If you can just not buy key equipment or not train somebody who is the only person who can provide the service, then you have a bureaucratic mechanism for instituting an effective constraint. So, for example, the British do about a fifth as much coronary artery surgery and angioplasty. It's where a balloon is threaded into the artery to enlarge a constriction. About a fifth as much as we do. You don't have operating room time. You don't have a cardiologist on hand or a cardiological surgeon. You can't do coronary surgery. So through personnel policies and investment policies,
they control the health.
You place the provider in a situation where they are doing all they can, but it isn't as much as it would be in an unconstrained system. So I think that's a lesson that we would take away.
I want to switch gears here for a moment. When you talk about some of the challenges facing the United States in talking about rationing, you talk about the cultural differences that exist between Americans and between British people. We don't have the same respect for doctors that they may. We're, I think, probably more rabble-rousers. What are some of those cultural challenges?
Well, I think that's critically important, although it is changing in Great Britain. Everybody we spoke to said, sometimes with enthusiasm, sometimes with regret, that the British patients are not as docile as they were in the past. They're becoming, the way they put it, more and more like Americans. But it does mean that Americans are more likely to get on the web. They're more likely to go into their physician and say, I've heard about this. Why aren't you giving me that? They're more likely to sue, although that, too, is a gap that's narrowing between Britain and the United States. And the threat of litigation does have an effect on physicians. So in general, on the response to limits, we would be and are far more sensitive than the British have been. They have lived with constrictions all their lives. We have not. On the other hand, we are starting from a level of expenditure so much higher than it is in Great Britain. We spend about 2.5 times per capita as much as the British do, adjusting for prices on health care. And that means that if we impose limits, the first steps, at least, are not going to be as draconian as the limits that we observe now in Great Britain. So I think there is a possibility for the imposition of some constraint on total spending. Again, I'm not specifying the mechanism in this study that would actually raise welfare. If we stop spending dollars that yield 10 cents worth of benefits on some marginal health care and shift that dollar into a dollar's worth of education that yields a dollar's worth of benefit for kids, or a dollar in better housing for hurricane victims, we raise welfare. We don't lower it. Now, I realize that's hard for the patient involved, losing the 10 cents worth of benefits. The point of this book, though, is we are moving into an era when the cost of health care will become so high that the nation as a whole is going to have to engage in a debate, a discussion about where we want to put our resources. And in that discussion, the message is either we are going to pay an awful lot of money and waste a good deal of it, or we're going to ration.
Final word. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you being with us today. Henry Aaron and colleagues are the authors of Can We Say No? I'm Jackie Judd. Thank you for joining us.